Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program, live from UN Climate Week. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll have the opportunity to ask questions during a Q&A session. Please note today's call is being recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Miriam Horn, the host of EDF Engage. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on our podcast, EDF Engage. I'm Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, and the host of EDF Engage. This afternoon, we're going to talk about Climate Week and the UN Climate Action Summit taking place here in New York City. I'm joined for that conversation by Nat Cohane, Senior Vice President of Climate at Environmental Defense Fund.
Hi, Miriam.
Also joining us today is Britt Grossman, Vice President of Global Climate at EDF. Britt is calling in from the UN to give us the highlights from the summit, which opened today. Hi, Britt.
Hi, Miriam.
We also have a special guest here in our studio, Shakti Ramkumar, a student activist and the head of communications for Student Energy, a group dedicated to empowering the next generation of energy leaders. Shakti is one of the millions of young people who took to the streets on Friday for the worldwide climate strike. Welcome, Shakti. We're so happy to have you here.
Hi.
We have lots to talk about, and later in the call, I want to bring all of you into the conversation, too. If you want to get in line to ask a question or make a comment, hit the star key and then 1. To reach an operator during the call, hit the star key followed by 0. You can also submit questions by email at edfengage@edf.org. So, Ned, I'm going to start with you and ask you to give us kind of a high-level view of what this meeting is. We hear a lot about climate meetings. We had the great big Global Climate Action Summit in California. We have the high-level UN talks every December, the COP talks. How does this meeting fit in, and what's special about it? How does it stand out?
Sure. Thanks, Miriam. I think I'll give two comments on that. I mean, one is the nature of the meeting themselves, but the other is where in time we find ourselves now. So just in terms of the landscape of meetings, as you say, there are meetings. The UN climate talks happen every year. That's when the countries get together to negotiate around the Paris Agreement. And then every few years, there is a sort of higher level meeting where leaders come together along with leaders from other sectors and get together to really focus on climate outside of those UN talks. Last year, we had the California summit. That was focused on subnational action, states and cities, which of course was Governor Brown's focus, as you remember. This one is being convened by the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, and he is asking, you know, not only leaders of countries who are in town anyways for the UN General Assembly, but also leaders from civil society, leaders from business, and across, you know, different sectors, multilateral organizations to come together. And so a big theme of this summit, which really is a whole week, it started really on Saturday, it hits its high point at the UN today, but it, you know, things continue through Thursday. The theme of that is really coalitions of countries and companies and civil society coming together. So that's what sets this sort of thing apart. I'll also just mention the context we find ourselves in. I think, you know, even since last year's climate summit in San Francisco, the evidence of extreme weather, the evidence that climate change is happening to us now, I think that evidence has become even more overwhelming. It was less than a year ago we had that report from the IPCC showing just what the consequences would be of a warming world beyond 1.5 degrees. This July was the hottest month ever recorded. Just yesterday, on Sunday, the World Meteorological Organization came out with a report saying that 2015 through 2019, this five-year period has been the five hottest years of ever recorded in terms of human history, so, or at least the recorded history, right? So we've got more evidence than ever. And meanwhile, we have rising awareness. You saw in the climate strikes, millions of students coming into the streets in New York and around the world. And so that's the context where this summit is occurring.
Great. Well, so Britt, you're actually over there at the UN and have been all day, maybe all weekend. Is this urgency that Nat has just described, the realization that it truly is getting hotter by the minute, and this energy from the streets, is it evident there? What's it? Just give us a sense of what it feels like over there.
Thank you, Miriam. Yes, I have been here all weekend. So the Secretary General had organized a youth summit on Saturday, which our guest Shakti can also speak about. And then yesterday there was a whole range of mini announcements, more working groups, more scrambling to get together. So there was definitely a sense of urgency in that people, I think, are worried that they may not be able to rise to the occasion, that the call is that big. And so there is sort of a little, sort of a frantic feeling around here. And then when Greta spoke this morning, holding back tears, I think we were all holding back tears. Her call to action was really chilling. Have we achieved it? Not totally clear. But I think you were going to come back to me on that later. But so the feeling is mixed. There's a feeling of, wow, how do we get there? The urgency is so big. How do we actually pull this off? But as Nat explained, it is really civil society and business together here. The Secretary General did very clearly ask not just for ambition in terms of a hollow statement of ambition that we may not be able to meet, but actually actions showing what you're going to implement to get there. And that requires civil society. That requires businesses. And I think that's why this summit is very different to a COP. It's very pragmatic. It's really about how do we do it? How do we implement our ambitions?
Well, that's sort of the sweet spot for EDF, I guess. So can you give us some examples of some of the most promising coalitions that you're seeing emerging over there?
Yes, would be happy to. So there is a couple that really stood out to me, some that we have been very involved with. One really is about international shipping. Shipping connects all countries and is growing rapidly. And we've had a coalition of 74 countries and companies from big private shipping companies like Maersk and the Port of Antwerp, so really sort of along the value chain, committing to going towards commercially viable zero-emission vessels by 2030. So we've heard a lot of the statements on ambition are sort of by 2050 net zero. So the fact that industry and ports and countries such as Denmark, Chile, Morocco have come together and say, look, we're going to do zero emission vessels by 2030, I thought was a very promising coalition and promising announcement. Another one is related to methane. A methane coalition was announced yesterday with IEA and UNEP around clean air, because we all know methane is a very sort of poignant, short-lived climate pollutant. And if we look at the youth around us, I have young children, I have children the age, my children were marching indeed. They need action, they want to see it now. And some of the things that they need to know is, yes, we're going to decarbonize, but at the same time, we know that decarbonizing industry takes, that there is a lead-in time to doing that. Whereas with methane, you can fix some of these fugitive emissions from mainly gas pipelines very easily, and you get results very quickly on a gas that is 87 times more poignant than other gases. So those are two of the big ones that stood out to me. But there were some others, things like Luxembourg's prime minister saying all public transport will be free from now on. Now, obviously, Luxembourg's a really small country, but imagine if every country in the world said every train, every bus, every tram is free from now on, what that would do for the way people see transport. So there was pockets of hope like that that were really interesting to hear. And actually, I think right now the UK is supposed to be making a big statement. I haven't heard of it yet, but they were teasing that they were going to close with a big statement that would lead us to COP26, which they are hosting.
Well, I'm sorry that we're pulling you away from the action, but let me ask you one more question since we have, which is just if you can tell us a little bit about EDF's role in both this shipping and this methane announcement.
Right. Yes, we'd love to. Well, we, as all the listeners know, EDF is very much founded on sound science. So we've been looking at the issue of methane emissions for a long time. In fact, we were one of the first environmental organizations that really could see the potential for that. And so we've been working with oil and gas companies, but then international organizations like UNEP and IEA, on how to really get some commitments going around that. And what we would really like to see is for every country to include methane specifically in their future NDCs under the Paris Agreement. So rather than just saying all greenhouse gases, we would love it if they could pull them out specifically, because they are special. They are, you know, not fungible. They are much more potent. So that's one thing where we really worked to sort of set the scene through doing the science. And with the shipping piece, this one really was an idea of our executive director in Europe, Baroness Bryony Worthington, who looked at sort of the value chain. What if ports were able to produce zero emission fuels at port using solar energy, for example, and that was then used to refuel the ships? What would that do? And we commissioned a report on that called Sailing on Solar that's been very influential, and that I think got both Morocco and Chile to come on board and sign on. So I'd say, without patting ourselves too much on the back, we were very influential in both those pieces.
Great. That's fascinating. Thank you. So Nat, let me turn back to you for a second and just to ask, I know you're going to be spending a fair bit of time over there, and Fred, can you tell us what else EDF is going to be doing as part of Climate Week?
Sure. Well, and in fact, as Britt mentioned, you know, it kicked off on Saturday, but it really goes off the week. You mentioned Climate Week. It becomes a whole week that extends through Thursday. And while the action today is over at the UN headquarters on the East River, where Britt is calling in from, over the next few days, and even starting today, there have been events, indeed over the weekend, events all over the city. So yesterday, for example, the Ford Foundation hosted several panels on energy action that I spoke at, and Baroness Bryony Worthington spoke at. Fred was part of this methane coalition that Britt mentioned. This morning at the Rockefeller Foundation, Fred and I were at a meeting to launch a new NGO, a new nonprofit called the Emergent Forest Finance Accelerator. It's a new facility that will transact high-quality forest carbon credits to help channel finance, private finance, into forest protection in the Amazon and other places. This is something EDF has been working on for a long time. We're now on the cusp, we think, of major changes to link markets to forest protection. Emergent, that we just announced today, will be a part of that. In fact, last week in Sacramento, the California Air Resources Board on the other side of the country took a big step in adopting a tropical forest standard that represents a step toward that, towards California taking those into the market. So that's an example of something, you know, there's a lot going on outside, and then it can crystallize in the kind of coalitions and announcements that are made at the summit. We'll also be doing, having nearly a dozen panels, some that we're hosting. We're hosting on new technologies to remove carbon from the sky, what those might look like in the future. We're hosting something on the investor perspective on climate change later on. You know, we'll also be speaking on panels around carbon pricing and carbon markets, as well as clean air throughout the week. So lots going on, and we're trying to make sure that EDF is as visible, you know, in our hometown as we can be.
Well, that's great. I know as we all watch the forest burning, the Emergent Forest Accelerator sounds like a really important move. So let me ask you a maybe somewhat dispiriting question, which is about our own country's participation in this event.
Yes, well, I mean, we were all geared up to, you know, the story to be that Trump didn't participate at all, and then he showed up for 15 minutes without even a translation headset. So either he's fluent in German and Hindi, or he wasn't really taking in the speeches that he was listening to from Merkel and Modi. I mean, all that joking aside, I think the absence of the U.S. in terms of any sort of main stage announcements, any sort of leadership, is striking. It echoes what was literally an empty chair at the G7 summit just a few weeks ago, when the G7 leaders got together. Climate was on the agenda, and Trump excused himself from the conversation for that, and there was an empty chair there. That empty chair, I think, symbolizes the absence of American leadership on this issue globally, which is, I think, you know, having it has, it makes it that much harder to get international cooperation going, and it really means that the U.S. is losing out on the opportunity to be a leader globally. The silver lining, or the only good news, is we are seeing more progress than we have in a long time, starting to happen in Washington, pushed by voters who are saying this is the most important issue to them or a top priority, pushed by the students who went out in the streets on Friday. So we're starting to see some evidence that Washington, D.C. is at least opening up a conversation on this. We're seeing bills introduced by both sides of the aisle, a big push to a 100% clean economy as the centerpiece of the potential action. That's not going to happen in next year. It's not going to happen this year, but we're laying the groundwork for that to happen potentially in the next 2 to 5 years. And so we're starting to see those green shoots. But for now, the administration we have in the White House is most evident by its absence at summits like this one.
So I just want to remind everyone that if you have a question, you can get into the queue by hitting the star key and then one. And you can also submit questions by email at edfengage@edf.org. So I want to move on to talk about youth more. I was struck, Greta Thunberg, when she was speaking to Congress, made exactly this point, that Sweden, many countries sit on their hands saying, if the U.S. isn't acting, why should we? And so the mobilization of youth in the streets seems incredibly critical. I had the opportunity to go down and join the climate strike on Friday and was really, really swept away by the size of the crowd, by the energy of and the imagination, the creativity of all these young and old that were gathered together. It was everything from, you know, the most ancient people to newborn babies, and just the feeling of mutual responsibility and care that was really there. It was really a wonderful place to be. Shakti, I know you were there too, and that your whole life now is dedicated to activating young people on solving this problem. Can you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to the climate fight?
Mm-hmm. So I started the climate fight quite young, even though I didn't know that's what it was. I moved here from India when I was 8 years old, and soon after I moved here, inspired by my parents, I became politically involved in my city. I was a science fair nerd. I did a lot of projects on demanding public transportation for my city and showing how that would reduce emissions, on phase change materials and ecological footprint. So that's kind of how I got started in the climate movement. And then into high school and university, the reason I got more and more active and engaged in different types of activism is really leadership led by indigenous people in BC. They are at the forefront of direct action and legal action, trying to protect BC from a lot of energy extraction projects that have been proposed over the years. We're still in the middle of one with the Trans Mountain Pipeline. And just seeing this leadership made it very clear to me that as a guest on unceded territory, I have a responsibility to also be part of this fight. And I've stayed in this fight because of the incredible community of friends that I formed. So I think I was asked recently, oh, is this such a burden? You must wake up every day saying, oh, it's time to fight for the climate. But I think it's the community of people and the joy that we go into this movement with that kind of keeps me going.
That's great. So BC, in case you haven't guessed, is British Columbia, which is where Shakti is joining us from. So tell us a little bit about Student Energy, what it does and what its goals are.
Mm-hmm. So Student Energy is a global nonprofit. We're based in Vancouver, but we have a network of over 50,000 young people in over 130 countries. And we were founded 10 years ago in 2009. And the reason we started was three young people realized that youth were really not being involved in any decision-making on energy. Even when we were at conferences, they realized, you know, they're being sat at the kids' table and not really having a chance to participate. So they decided we'll host our own summit. So they brought together young people from around the world, and now it's now the largest international student-led energy summit in the world. This year, we held our sixth annual one. It was brought together 650 people from 98 countries in London, and it's one of the only energy summits in the world where the people asking the questions and developing the solutions are all young people and are working together. So our main goal with Student Energy is to accelerate the sustainable energy transition, and we think we can do that by empowering young people and building capacity in young people, because that's where we're seeing leadership, ambition, and true innovation is in young people. So that's our main goal at the organization.
That's great. And tell us a little bit about both how you're connected to EDF and how you're connected to the summit.
Mm-hmm. So with EDF, actually, we were really excited to partner with EDF. We were connected through the UN Climate Action Summit team. We've been working with various different civil society and government organizations, including Sustainable Energy for All. And through them, we got into contact with the UN Climate Action Summit team. And we worked with EDF to deliver the Next Generation Technology and Youth Movements track. It was part of the Energy Action Area for the summit. And we were really, really lucky to have an incredible couple of panels during the summit moderated by youth, with youth on a panelist, which is something we try to bring forth in any activity that we do, is always have youth represented. We also held a solutions hackathon and an intergenerational hackathon where we paired young people and members of the older generation and had them work out policy and technology challenges in energy. So that's been our most recent collaboration with EDF.
That's fantastic. So how do you think we keep this momentum going? Where do you see the youth movement going?
Mm-hmm. I think there is mounting social pressure for sure. And what makes this youth movement, I think, unlike any other is that young people refuse to be siloed. They're not just asking for 100% renewable energy. They are asking, they're demonstrating that actually we have a historical responsibility to reverse a lot of the damages that we've done and to tackle systemic racism and to tackle ecological injustice and economic inequality and gender inequality. So that's why I think this youth movement is different than any other. And from our network of over 50,000 young people, we see that they see energy as a way to kind of address all of these different issues of justice and equity. And kind of transitioning the energy system is a way that we can kind of intervene in all these different areas. So I think first we're building, we're kind of changing the conversation on energy and climate, and that's where the youth movement is making an impact. And next is to just electoralize. Young people are mobilizing and engaging their peers to vote. And I think it's making a case that, you know, anyone who wants to represent a group of people in the future will be defined by their position on climate change as an issue. And that's something that hasn't happened yet, but it's on its way there.
Well, that's very heartening that you guys are going to keep up that pressure, because that does seem critical. I want to start bringing people on the phone into this conversation, so just want to remind you that if you want to ask a question, hit the star key and then one. If your question is answered while you're waiting, you can remove yourself from the queue by hitting the pound key, and if you need to reach the operator, just hit the star key followed by zero. So, operator, let's go first to a question from the phone.
Certainly. We'll go to Emma Tainter. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. So my question is, what is EDF doing to inspire young people to act on climate change?
Well, great. So, yes, we've heard from one of our partners on youth, but EDF also has its own activist group, Defend Our Future, the initiative that EDF started about 5 years ago, focused on getting college students out, as you mentioned, to vote on climate. We do have actually Matt Oberhofner is on the call with us, and Matt, if you don't mind, maybe I'll ask you to answer that question.
Hi, sure. Thanks, Miriam, and great to see you in New York at the climate strike on Friday as well. There's a ton of energy and excitement around this across the country. We are about 40,000 strong across the country, and on Friday we were engaged in a number of strikes around the country, including New York, D.C., Philadelphia, Raleigh, Austin, Charlottesville, Virginia, Madison, Wisconsin, and Phoenix, Arizona. We're using this as an organizing vehicle for Climate Week, so we really wanted to make sure that folks who came out and had all that enthusiasm and excitement around the climate strike, but they knew that that was not the end of the action, that that was the beginning of a week of action around Climate Week. And so we're using that to pivot to advocacy. So really encouraging anyone who showed up at a march or a rally to take a photo of themselves and send that to their member of Congress to demonstrate that there's a connection between marching and acting. I think as folks may know, tomorrow is National Voter Registration Day. So we're asking people to get 5 of their friends to register to vote so that we can make a big difference in the upcoming elections. And certainly we've seen what a difference that young people can make when they turn out. And we need to turn that marching into voting. It can't just be about a single day of action. It has to be about getting folks out and engaged on an ongoing basis. Young people don't need to be convinced that climate change is a problem. We know that. So it's not about winning hearts and minds. It's about motivating and mobilizing and really, really showing that we can make a difference and showing them how to make that difference.
Great. Thank you so much, Matt. So again, if you want to ask a question, hit star one. Now, we've gotten some questions by email. George Montgomery wrote to ask about China, that we see China taking steps forward and steps backwards. It's taking steps forward in developing these emissions trading markets that EDF has been very instrumental in developing, but it's also developing new coal plants both within China and elsewhere in the world. So how does that net out? Are we ending up ahead with China's action in the world or holding still, or what's the net effect?
Thanks, Miriam, and thanks to George for a great question. If he's on the phone as well. So I think that the direction that China takes over the next 5 or 10 years is really one of the handful of things that's going to determine the fate of the planet, frankly, on this issue. And what I mean by that is China has made significant strides. I mean, if you look in the sort of the space of time in which it's gone from being a country just at the beginning of its industrial revolution, basically in its industrialization, which was really 30 years ago, to having rapidly preceded that, becoming the largest emitter in the world, and now taking really genuine steps inside the country, including, as you mentioned, the emissions trading system that we're working with the government on, taking genuine steps, it made a Paris target of peaking its carbon emissions by 2030. We think it could do that 5 years ahead of schedule, and it will do that if it has the right policies in place. And it's doing that because that helps its air quality, which is critical for its population's health. It helps China. It helps position China as a leader in the world, which it wants to be as it grows into the ranks of top tier countries. And it also it positions China as a leader in clean technology and clean energy. It's the world's largest producer of renewables and battery storage and so on. The question, as you say, is as it makes investments, in particular in the rest of the world, it actually is slowing down investments in new coal plants. But the question is, will it export all of those coal plants to countries like Indonesia and Thailand and India, or will it export green technologies and export the policies like an emissions trading system? This is why I say that is the big fork in the road. China has this huge initiative called the Belt and Road Initiative. We are working, EDF China program, and our head, Zhang Jianyu, is the head of the Green BRI Coalition and the international liaison in China, very closely connected to that effort. But the success we have in turning that towards a green future will be a critical determinant about which way the planet goes.
And so right at this particular moment?
So far I think China is making significant progress, and what we're trying to do is support that progress both internally with the kind of domestic policies that can help peak emissions sooner, but also help persuade the Chinese government that green path, exporting green technology, that's the way to really show leadership, to position China as a leader for the 21st century, rather than exporting the 20th century technologies of coal.
Right, great. Thank you. So, okay, so again, a reminder that if you want to ask a question, hit star one. And operator, could we have another question from the phone, please?
Certainly. We'll go to Ron Kaltenbaugh. Please go ahead.
Hello. Climate solutions are still viewed by many as being expensive when, in fact, over the long run, they're generally less expensive. How do we change the conversation around this so that we can bring in people that don't care about climate but care about saving money?
Yep, that's a question right up your
alley. Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you, Ron, for that question. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. There's a perception about the cost that I think doesn't take into account many of the recent technological changes. Just in the last decade, we've seen dramatic reductions in the cost of renewable technologies like wind and solar. We've also critically seen improvements in cost reductions in the cost of battery storage, which is so important. We're seeing electric vehicles out on the roads and the cost coming down of those vehicles. So, you know, changing our energy economy and transforming our economy towards low carbon will take significant investments, but we know that those investments, first of all, will result in cleaner, more affordable, more accessible energy here and around the world. And they also they represent huge opportunity in terms of technological innovation and progress. And the costs of that investment are a tiny fraction of the cost of not doing anything and of the inaction, at the cost of inaction in terms of climate damages. So we are making, I think, increasingly people see, around the country and around the world, they see renewable power as a cost-effective, cheaper form of electricity, and that's key. So in the electric power sector, that's already happening. And we need to continue to make that case. And people will begin to see, I think, that those technologies are in many cases cheaper than the old ones they're replacing. But we also need to make sure to let policymakers know and make sure policymakers recognize the cost of inaction, which is much, much greater than the investments that need to be made to turn our economy around.
And Nat, you're involved in a panel this week, I think, about the risk, that how investors are starting to build risk into their investment decisions. Is that right?
Yeah, so you're starting to see, in addition to consumers that are making choices and looking for cleaner technologies that are fast becoming cheaper, you're seeing investors look to move towards investments that are going to be essentially insured against climate risk. Now, a big part of moving much more investment capital will be putting the right policies in place. And so especially in the U.S., we need to have federal legislation in place that helps make some of those costs of putting carbon into the atmosphere, that makes some of those costs visible. But even now, you see investors really taking a close look at the kind of physical impacts that climate change is happening and what that means for the investments they're making, and how they need to change and alter their investment approaches to take account of those climate risks.
Great. So we had another question come via email, and I think I'd like all of you to weigh in on this. Britt, I don't know whether you'll be able to bring us any news from the front, but it's a question about technology and the role technology plays, and certainly in energy, technology plays a critical role. Nat, I know you and Fred have wrote a piece about the possibility of technologies that take carbon out of the atmosphere. So why don't I start with you, Shakti, and just talk about how you see technology, energy technology in particular, playing a role in this future, and then ask you, Nat, to talk about carbon reduction. And Britt, if there's any hot news breaking over there, you can jump in too.
Yeah, for sure. I think of the youth movement, technology plays a really important role. A lot of the new technologies are being innovated and implemented by young people, and there's a lot of excitement around this. I think there's also some degree of caution around who is designing this technology, who will it benefit, who will it impact adversely. And this is something that young people, particularly in the Student Energy Network, are really paying attention to. For example, a lot of renewable energy projects, despite their clean energy advantages, they don't benefit communities who actually need the energy access. There are still so many communities in Canada that rely on diesel and don't have access to reliable electricity. So even when there is all this new technology and exciting development, We need to consider who is it benefiting and are we making sure there's equity while we implement this new technology. And another factor I think is really important to consider is the ownership over this technology and reducing barriers to access. At Student Energy, all of our programs, we try to reduce as many barriers as possible, whether they're financial, geographical, professional. We try to reduce those barriers, and it's no different with technology. I think a lot of technology and data is increasingly becoming proprietary, and for a lot of youth, that means they are going to be excluded from how they use this technology. So I think supporting open and accessible technology is really important in the energy transition.
Great. Thank you. And Nat, can you tell us a little bit about the carbon reduction, negative emissions? I don't know what the term of art is these days.
Sure. Well, I'll start by saying I love what Shakti said about the importance of making sure that energy is accessible, that energy access that we have, that it's serving an equitable and just transition, and making sure that that's front and center. Especially in terms of getting out so many of the technologies we have, we just need to make sure they're available. And then if you think about how do we, get the next frontier of technologies, that's another area where EDF is very focused, and we're getting more and more focused, first on what government can do, in this country and other countries to really double down on investment in clean energy investment in clean energy R&D and in innovation. That's a really important role for public funding to be doing upstream basic science R&D, but also innovation into new clean energies. This is something that the government has historically done in a range of technologies, and we should be doubling or tripling our R&D budget. And as a part of that, Miriam, you mentioned carbon dioxide removal or negative emissions technologies. That's an area, it sounds futuristic because we're talking about technologies and approaches that can take carbon out of the sky, and it's not something that we have. There are some things like trees. We already have a great technology in trees to take carbon out of the sky, but when you start talking about new technologies, that's not, it's not right here, right now. That's still in the early pilot stages. But the potential that would hold if we could develop technologies that cost-effectively removed carbon out of the sky, it wouldn't be a substitute for mitigation. We need to be moving aggressively to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce carbon emissions, to take carbon out of the economy. If we could also develop technologies that take it out of the atmosphere, then we could reverse some of the harm that we've already done. We could pull some of the pollution that's already into the atmosphere out and help restore the climate that we need. So we could go even further if we had those technologies. So working now to make investments in that sort of innovation and the research and development that's going to drive that is critical. And as you say, we're having a panel with a U.S. A former Department of Energy, Secretary of Energy, Ernie Moniz, is coming out with a report at a panel we're doing tomorrow as part of Climate Week to learn and to talk more about those kind of technologies.
And is there one worth highlighting that seems particularly promising to you?
Well, I mean, there's a whole range. The one that's the most almost fantastical but has huge potential, but we need to really be kicking the tires on the scientific potential, which is part of what EDF is doing. As Britt said, we're founded on science, so we need to make sure we're taking a really hard look. But the one that has extraordinary potential is called direct air capture, which is literally taking carbon out of the atmosphere. There's some pilot plants already in scale. They look like huge row upon row of enormous fans that are pulling carbon out. The question is, can you do that at a cost-effective level? In other words, can you get the cost down so that it becomes a viable source of removing carbon from the sky? That's something we need to figure out. And that's why, investing in R&D can help answer that question, but it's promising enough that you need to answer that question and start to take that look. And this is, we're at very early stages, but it's exciting to think about the potential there. There are also a range of other things, I should say, but that's the one that sort of catches the science fiction, catches your eye in a sense.
Great. So I'm going to offer one last reminder that if you want a question, star one is the way to get into the queue. And then, Nat, we have another question from email. I'm sorry to be piling up all these questions on you, but this is, again, in your home court here, which is about just to give us kind of an update on the existing cap-and-trade markets around the world and how they're functioning and what we're learning from them.
Sure. And you know, this is something that EDF has championed for a long time, precisely because we think that the way to get to the ambitious reductions in carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions that we need, if we're going to do that at the pace and the scale that that the science demands, we have to use, you know, we have to harness one of the most powerful forces we have, which is the power of markets. But we need to harness that by creating incentives that align what businesses and private sector and investors and entrepreneurs are doing, align that with low carbon. And a good way to do that is to put in place market-based policies that set a limit on carbon pollution that declines over time, an enforceable limit, but gives firms the flexibility to meet that limit by through a market, a cap and trade market, or a market for allowances. This is something the state of California has done, and recently, just a couple years ago, ratcheted down their cap, took on a more ambitious 2030 cap of 40% below 1990 levels using a cap and trade system. Europe has a cap and trade system in place that had, you know, early on in the Great Recession, had, you know, they saw prices go really low as the economy cratered, but they put in some reforms that have really strengthened the performance of that system. And so that's now on track to help Europe get a 40% cut in emissions reductions below 1990, again by 2030, a similar target to California's. As I mentioned earlier, we see China putting in place a program building on pilot programs at the provincial level. They're now looking for an emissions trading system at the national level. South Korea, New Zealand, other countries are pursuing this as well. From our perspective, again, this is all about ambition. We did an analysis at EDF that suggests that if you look at the investment that's being made by countries to meet their commitments under the Paris Agreement, and then you say, well, what if we made that same investment but we did it cooperatively through markets instead of having every country act alone? We took advantage of markets to take advantage of wherever the cheapest, fastest emissions reductions are available throughout the world. We found you could almost double the amount of emissions reductions you got for that same investment. And of course, if you invested more, you'd get even more payback. So that's the power of markets. They're not a silver bullet. We need a whole range of other policies in place to reduce barriers to energy efficiency and promote access and all the things that Shakti was talking about. But we think a market can be a powerful driver. The last thing I'll say, just very quickly, one of the most interesting markets that's just on the horizon is going to be in the aviation sector. So starting in 2021, international emissions from the aviation sector will be capped at 2020 levels, and airlines will be able to have a kind of market mechanism to meet that. Now, we need to do more than just keeping emissions in that sector constant. We need to cut them in half or more. We need to get carbon out of aviation, but it's an important start. And if we can show that initial program succeeds, then we can start driving up ambition and driving down emissions in the aviation sector.
Great, and that has promise for forests too, right?
Yes, exactly, so, exactly.
A nice bit of funding. So, okay, well, thank you. That was our last question. I want to thank everyone for joining us on this call. We'll have a recording of it online at blogs.edf.org/podcast. And if you want additional information or a CD recording, you can contact Matt Piper at 212-616-1407 or mpieper@edf.org. And we'll be back for another discussion with EDF experts and partners on EDF Engage. So stay tuned for more information, and thank you all again.
Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you.
Thank you.